John chapter 4, starting in verse 43 this morning as our passage, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what it has to say for us today. But let's read. It says, after 2 days, he, meaning Jesus, departed for Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. The official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. They said to him, yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him. The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Well, as I said, we're in the Gospel of John. And if you look at the end of our passage this morning, it says something kind of interesting. John says something kind of interesting, that this was the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. If you remember, in John's Gospel, all the way back to where we started in John's Gospel, John talks about this, and he doesn't include all of the miracles of Jesus, all of the teaching and the events and or these signs. He doesn't include all of the signs Jesus did during his time on earth. Rather, John chooses to highlight seven. And these seven signs, or these signs that John includes, are designed to give us a clear and powerful picture that helps us understand and believe in Jesus in the way that brings righteousness with God and eternal life with him. If we remember John's purpose in writing, and he states it in chapter 20, where he says that Jesus did other signs that are not written here, but these signs are written so that we may believe, so that we can have true faith that Jesus is the Christ, or he's the Messiah, he's the Son of God, so that he's God in the flesh, and that by believing we can have life in his name. So he has these seven signs, or it's kind of like when we talked about John as like a trial lawyer, right? And he's convincing us to believe that Jesus is in fact God in the flesh and worth believing in. And what he's doing is he's presenting seven pieces of evidence that will help convince. Okay, and seven again is the number of completion. So he says, I'm giving you all you need. And if you remember, back in chapter 2 was the first sign. Do you remember what the first sign was? It was when Jesus changed the water into wine. In fact, that sign was done, that miracle was done, interestingly enough, in Cana as well, Cana of Galilee, when he went to the wedding with his mother, his family, his disciples, and they ran out of wine, and he changed the water into wine. And in that, John says this is a picture of Jesus showing that he has power, the power of God, so he is God, but also that Jesus is showing his purpose in coming, in turning this water into wine. And we talked about what that was all about. And if you want to hear all about it, you can go back and listen to it. I'm not going to rehash all of that because we're talking about the second one today. So we look at this next sign, this next piece of evidence that John includes. So since it's one of these signs, and John says this, our ears should perk up a little bit. And we should say, something's coming, and there's something about this story that's very important for us to grasp, that will help us better grasp Jesus and find life in him. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to go through this passage and we're going to look at what happens so that we can discover why this story in particular is so important as a sign. So it begins in verse 43 and it kind of gets the setting, right? Remember the setting. Jesus was in Galilee and Cana and all of this. Then he goes down to Jerusalem for the feast, the Passover feast. While he's there, he ruffles some feathers, doesn't he? He ruffles some feathers, and then he goes out into the Judean countryside, and he's teaching and he's baptizing, but then he kind of gets pushed out of there, so he decides, well, we're going to go back to our home base of operations, which is Galilee. And they pass through Samaria, and he stops at a well, meets a Samaritan woman who he leads to true faith in him, and then he spends 2 days with the townspeople there, transforming a whole community, really, and it's at these end of these 2 days, he continues this journey north to Galilee. So that's the setting. And then in verse 44, John includes something that's kind of interesting, because he says, if you remember, Jesus testified himself that a prophet is without honor in his own hometown. And you may say, all right, so if he's without honor, he's going to some place he will be honored. But I thought his hometown was in Nazareth, right? Isn't that where Jesus was raised? He was raised in Nazareth. Well, Nazareth is in Galilee. So how can it say he's without honor if he's going to this place? Because John isn't talking about Jesus' hometown in Nazareth. You see, Nazareth was Jesus' hometown as Jesus the man. Here, Jesus, this story is all about Jesus, God in the flesh. So Jesus, God in the flesh, the promised Messiah, all through the Old Testament was promised it was going to come through the line of Judah or the tribe of Judah, which is actually located or was located where Judea is. And he was coming as God in the flesh. Where is God's home here on earth? It was at the temple, right? The place where God dwelt. And the temple is in Jerusalem. So here John's saying this place where Jesus was not honored, his hometown, is Jerusalem. And if we look back, that's what happened, right? The religious leaders started giving Jesus a hard time, and then the crowd started following Jesus like he was some circus act, showing him no honor, just that he was doing these miracles and things, and wow, isn't this cool? And Jesus decried their faith, didn't he? But yet when he comes up to Samaria, he's honored, he's celebrated. In fact, they asked him to stay 2 more days. And then when he goes into Galilee, it says the Galileans welcomed him, right? Verse 46. That the Galileans welcomed him. Why? Because they had seen all he did, and they weren't offended by it. Actually, they were encouraged by it when they were down in Jerusalem. So this is where Jesus is honored, Jesus as God in the flesh. So that's kind of setting the stage here. Now, before, verse 46, so we see he's in Cana of Galilee. And again, it's this place where he had done to date, probably his greatest miracle, turning this water into wine in this first sign. And while he's in Cana, there's this royal official, some translations call him, in Capernaum. Capernaum is about 25 miles north. It's actually where Jesus' home base of operations is, where many of his disciples are from. But he hears that Jesus is in Cana. And this official, his son is ill. So he comes down to Cana, or south to Cana, to ask Jesus to heal his son, because his son is at the point of death. So here's kind of the reason for this conversation to happen. And so we kind of have that. So again, Jesus is here, and he goes to Cana. Cana is where Nathanael was from. It was also where this miracle of the wet water into wine. And this official comes, and he comes down and says, heal my son. Now, we're not told who this official is or much about the son, but we can gain a lot from what it's kind of talking about. First of all, we know that this guy is an important person. He's an official. He's a royal official, which means he's probably from the court of Herod, who is the regional king. And it means he's probably Jewish, but yet he's not really religious Jew. But he's a pretty important person, and he's a man of great wealth, isn't he? We notice this because he can travel freely, but it's also mentioned that he has servants, and it also is mentioned that it talks about the seventh hour a little bit later in this, which is John is choosing, since this guy is more cultured Roman, he's using Roman time, which is 7 at night in the evening. So that means when they notice his son starts recovering at 7 at night, he has a doctor there off hours, which means you're probably pretty prominent if you can get this kind of medical care for your son. But he's an aristocrat, so he's not very religious. He's not a guy who's looking for the Messiah. What is most evident about this official is he's at his wit's end right now. He's desperate, right? Picture this. His son first falls ill, and he's sitting there saying, well, let's get all the doctors in. Let's get the best medical care we can have to get my son right again. Yet something happens. Despite all of his best efforts, his son continues to decline. His condition worsens. So as a last resort almost, in desperation, he reaches out to Jesus because he had heard about this Jesus. But yet he wouldn't go to Jesus first because, again, he's an educated man. He's a wealthy man. This is what the commoners do. This is what people who are weak and believe in fairy tales do. Does this sound familiar to what some people talk about Christianity? And what fairy tale believers do. You know, not an educated man like me. I would never do that. But now he's at the point of saying, I'm going to try anything, so I better go see Jesus. And he makes this journey, this 25-mile journey, a whole day's journey down to Cana. Now, although this is a story about this healing, and it's important, again, John's purpose is to present some evidence. And what this evidence is about here, or what is being taught here in our message, is about true faith. Again, it's so that we can believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing, find life in his name. So what John is doing is the second sign is all about what true faith is all about. He's building this case. What does it really look like to have true faith? And what we find here so far in this story is the first of three truths that build true faith. You see, these truths, that they're not just true for this man. They're not just true for the setting here. These are kind of universal truths or principles that even apply to us today about what true faith is all about. And these are some truths about how true faith is built or how we get to the point of true faith. And what we discover as this royal official comes to Jesus is, first of all, this first truth is that we will all face more than we can do for ourselves. At some time or another, we will find in our life that something that we can't accomplish or achieve all things. We can't handle everything. Something's going to come that's going to be more than we ourselves, we as mankind, can do. This is a reality we're all going to face, and this is where this man finds himself. You know, he's got education, he's got position, he's got wealth, and he has status, and he really wants for little in life. If he needed something, he could go get it. Yet this was outside of his ability, outside of his power, outside of his control. And not coming to terms with this truth, you know, this is what has kept and is keeping so many people from coming to Christ throughout history. Even in our world today, from even considering Jesus, much less putting their faith in him. In fact, it's kind of what's behind the whole philosophy of humanism. Have you heard about humanism? Humanism basically says man is the measure of all things and the solution for all things. Man can fix everything. If it's broke, we can come together. If it's not a single person, it's us coming together as humankind because we are the world and we can fix anything. Now, God has created humankind uniquely. I mean, we're created in God's image. And there is so much that we as human beings can do. I mean, if we look throughout history, all of the advancements, you know, in medicine and travel and technology, you know, all these inventions and things and all of these things, man can do a lot. Really can. It's staggering what man has figured out as God has gifted him to. Yet man is not the measure of all things. And man cannot achieve all things. no matter the technical or scientific breakthroughs, man can't heal every ailment. There are some things that mankind cannot heal or cannot prevent. I mean, you've heard it says there's still no cure for the common cold. Something so simple sounding, and yet all of our medicine can't figure out how to cure that. And we can do a lot medically and scientifically, yet there are some things we can't do. So we can't heal every animal. We can't control the weather, all the weather. We can't save this planet. You know, this idea of climate change, it's a real thing. Now, what causes it, we don't know, because it's outside of our control in many senses. So no matter how much we put things into play, there's still going to be aspects of it that are outside of our control. Because storms have happened throughout the history of man. Events have happened. Things have happened. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean we shouldn't care. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be seeking medical advancements and pouring into science things that we can do. It doesn't mean we should ignore our environment and just say, well, it's fake, it's false. No, we should take care of it. Why? Because God's made us stewards of it. But we need to realize that even though we can care for these things and we can make things better, we have to realize there's always going to be things that we, that you, that me, cannot do ourselves. And that's the point where this guy gets to. And when we hit this reality, that we realize that something's out of our control, one of two things usually happens, and usually the first leads to the second eventually, but the first thing that can happen is rebellion. We get angry, don't we? Because something's out of our control, and we want to get control, so we rebel against our lack of control. We lash out. We try to destroy things and end up destroying ourselves and things, trying to get this control. And the other thing that can happen, though, is that in desperation, we look outside ourselves for help, for rescue. And this is usually where the first leads to eventually. But we look for something. We grasp for something. And a lot of times that's for other false gods, and sometimes it's for the true God. In fact, that's where the whole saying came from in war, there are no atheists in foxholes. You're in a foxhole, and you're in war, and everything's going on around you, and you don't know what else to do. You reach to God, right? It's also why our media, who spends most of their time trying to silence any mention of God, when there's a crisis, they call on the nation to come together and pray. Because in times of desperation, we'll grasp for anything. And this is what this royal official is doing, coming to Jesus. And it's also how this truth then can help build true faith in Jesus, because as we start to realize things we can't do, we soon will realize we can't be good enough to save ourselves, to be right with God. You see, one thing we need to realize is no matter how good we are, no matter how what our status is, no matter how much influence we have or means we have, no matter how many times we go to church or how many times we pray, we can never be good enough in and of ourselves to be right with God. It's the biggest thing we can't do. You know, one day a rich young ruler, a man of status, came to Jesus when he was teaching the crowds. And he had all the means you could want. And he even had the outward religious appearances that he had it all together. And he comes to Jesus for Jesus to pat him on the back. Instead, Jesus sends him away, miserable, frustrated, because he couldn't abandon all that he had to follow or trust Jesus alone. And it was interesting because then Jesus makes the point. You know, it's easier for someone, for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a man of means to be saved. And to that, the crowd began to murmur and they say, well, then how can anybody be saved? And here's what Jesus told him in Luke 18. He says, "With what is impossible with man is possible with God." You see, and that's where it kind of gets us. Paul reminds us of this, right, in Titus. He says that God saves us not because of works done by us in righteousness, or not by our goodness, but according to his own mercy. It's him. It's not us. We can do the most righteous works we can possibly do, and it's still not going to be good enough. We're all going to come to this point where we face more than ourselves. And true faith begins when we come to grips with this first truth. And it will lead us to Jesus. However, there's more to true faith than just coming to Jesus, as we find out in this story, as we continue here. So back to our passage, verse 48. So this man says you need to come down to Cana, which is south of Capernaum, but it's down in elevation, so that's why he says come down. And he says you need to come down and heal my son. And Jesus kind of slaps him down, doesn't he? He says, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. What's he saying here? Well, in essence, here's what Jesus is saying. The only way you're going to believe in me is if I give you what you want and I become your servant. I become Santa Claus. This is the only way you're going to believe in me, is if I do exactly what you want. And if I don't, then you're not going to believe in me. So that's not real belief. But the man's desperate, right? And that's how many people believed him. Remember when he was down in Jerusalem and said many in the crowd followed him for the works he had done? But he said, but Jesus says, but I know their heart. It's not good enough. That's not true faith. And this is what Jesus is kind of saying again here. And this man kind of shows his desperation, his tenacity, and he tells Jesus, he says, you need to come or else my son will die. Can you feel the man's pain here? Can you feel his longing? If you're a parent, you kind of get this, right? I got to do something. Please. He's going to die. You need to come. Jesus doesn't tell him he's going to come, does he? Instead, he tells him, look at verse 50. He says, go. Your son will live. And it's interesting because it says, the man believed what Jesus said, or he believed the words of Jesus. Well, because you said it, okay. That's still not true faith. It's better than what he had before, that now he's saying, all right, well, this is what Jesus said, so I believe his words. But he's not believing in him yet. He's just believing his words. But he believes his words, and he's able to go. Now, it says he went his way. He doesn't go directly home. Again, we learn later that it's the seventh hour, which is 7 o'clock at night. You're not going to go 25 miles overnight. It's not like you hop in a car. He'd be walking at night with, you know, thieves on the road and everything. So he spends the night in Cana and goes in the morning, okay? But before all this happens, we find another truth in this conversation Jesus and this man has, where Jesus kind of shuts him down but then says, go, your son will live. And all of this, as this man comes, second truth we need to embrace, to have true faith in Jesus, this kind of faith that trusts alone in Jesus and brings life in him. You see, faith is built when we grasp the second truth is that Jesus can do more than we think he can. So the first is that we're all going to face more than we can do ourselves. The second is that Jesus can do more than we think he can. You see, this guy thinks Jesus can do something. You can heal my son. But Jesus can do more than that. And this man doesn't understand that. He believed what Jesus told him, that your son would be well. I mean, what choice did he have at this point? He wasn't going to get Jesus to budge. But in looking at this conversation, what we find here is we find three faulty assumptions that this man has in relation to Jesus and what Jesus could do. This man kind of had three things that he believed that weren't true about Jesus because he didn't know Jesus. Here's the first assumption that he went on. First assumption that was faulty that he had is he believed that he had to tell Jesus about his son. He had to let Jesus know. The guy assumed that Jesus wouldn't know that his son was sick and at the point of death if he didn't tell him. That's why he didn't even send servants. He went himself. He needed to tell Jesus how important it was. what this official failed to understand is that Jesus is no mere man. He's God in the flesh, the same God that knows all things. Just as Jesus earlier on, we found that he knew Nathanael's name before Nathanael even said it. He knew everything the woman at the well had done even before she told him. This same Jesus knows all things. And he knew about this son, just as he knows all things. In fact, Jesus knows what we're facing. He sees us right where we are. More importantly, he cares because he is God. Now, that doesn't mean we don't come to him and we don't bare our heart to him and we don't tell him things and we don't pray for things. But what it does mean is it gives us comfort to know that he already knows. He's already caring and he's already at work. So when we come, we can just find comfort in that. But Jesus knows. And this man didn't realize that. See, Jesus can do a lot more than he thought he could, than thought he knew. Second faulty assumption he had was that this man had was that he thought Jesus needed to come to his son's side to heal him. That's why he says twice, "You need to come down to Capernaum to heal my son. You need to come and heal him." The man was adamant about that, right? But Jesus didn't. Eventually, the man took what he could get, but reluctantly, right? But here's the deal. Jesus doesn't have to be right there to heal his son. Jesus could have done it in a word. In fact, he does, doesn't he? See, this man didn't understand that. Or he would have just said, "Hey, can you heal my son? Just say it." But he didn't. He says, you have to come. Why? Because you have to be there to do it. Just because we can't see Jesus doesn't mean he's not working. Just because we can't sense his presence all the time. Because I don't know about you, there's times I don't sense his presence. There's times I feel all alone or I feel confused or things like that. But to know that Jesus is always there, whether I sense him or not. See, nothing stands in the way of Jesus being able to do whatever he sets his mind to do. So this man had that faulty assumption. The third faulty assumption, he wrongly thought that the only way the boy could be healed is if the boy was still alive. Look what he says to Jesus. He says, "You need to come or else he's going to die, and then it's done. It'll be too late." Is anything too late for Jesus? Right? What is that to Jesus? He's the author of life. In fact, a little later in John 11, we're going to see this with one of his buddies, Lazarus, who was sick, and Jesus didn't make it in time. Everybody says, "You're too late." He says, "I'm not too late." And he goes to the grave and he says, "Lazarus, come forth." And Lazarus rose from the dead. He was healed. He didn't have to be alive to be healed. Why? Because Jesus is the giver of life. He's the giver. So he can bring life and wholeness whenever he desires. This man didn't know Jesus. He just knew about Jesus. So he didn't know all of these things. Again, Jesus is all about giving life, isn't he? And this is something that John points out here. He's all about giving life. True faith trusts not in ourselves, but in Jesus who can all do all things. In fact, Paul gives a wonderful description about what Jesus can do and why Jesus can do all things. It's in Colossians chapter 1. Here's what Paul says about Jesus. "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authority. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God is pleased to dwell." You get that? Jesus is over all things. All things came into being through him. What is impossible for him? And this is all great. And true faith is now being built. And to say, all right, all things are possible through Jesus. Great. He can do all things. That's great. I believe what Jesus can do now. But that's not true faith. You see, although we're looking to him and realizing he can do anything, we're merely trusting in his ability. There's more needed to truly trust Jesus in this way that brings us life. And John gets at that. Look at verse 51. It says he's going down. So this is the next morning. So now he's going back to Capernaum. He doesn't know what to believe, right? He's like, Jesus just told me this, but I didn't really get what I was after. But he starts going home. And as he goes home, he's met by some of his servants who come running down to him on the way. Who knows how long they ran to greet him. And they said, guess what? Your son is recovering. He's getting well. The fever broke. He's going to be fine. That had to be great news. But something clicks in this guy. And he goes, when did he start getting better? When did this happen? And they said, it was at the seventh hour yesterday when the fever left him. Notice it wasn't progressive. The fever left him. Then we come to verse 53, but it says, so he, what do you know, by sheer coincidence, the exact time that Jesus said your son will live is the exact time the fever broke and the son became well. Imagine that, right? Again, nothing Jesus does is random, is it? And at this point, I think it all comes crashing down on this guy, right? In a moment. This is no coincidence. This is no mere miracle worker, this Jesus. This isn't just about healing my son. This man, Jesus, is something more. He must be something more. He must be who he says he is, God in the flesh. And it says, now he believed. Wait a minute, he believed his words. Now he believes what? He believes in Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, and in believing finds life in his name. This belief isn't just getting what he wanted because he already got what he wanted. He already found out his son was well. He already got what he wanted, so why does he need to believe? That's like foxhole belief, right? You get out of the struggle and you're just like, woo, I can get back to my life now until the next crisis. Then I'll cling to God again. He doesn't do this. Something fundamentally changes in him, and it's because he finally gets true belief. This is life-changing. It's family-altering belief. Look what it says. Not only does he believe, but all his household believes. Do you know what that means? That means this man leads his family to understand who Jesus is. This is more than just some miracle worker, more than some circus side performer that people follow, that I thought he was, could just give me what I needed. This is something more, and we need to trust in him. And from that moment on, his whole family dynamic has changed, isn't it? If he and his family now believe in this, and the crisis is past, then they're believing beyond the crisis just for everyday life, and the way they're going to face everyday life is now different than they did the day before. This is transformative belief, isn't it? True faith in Jesus. And what it does is it brings us to our final truth about true faith found in our story this morning. You see, not only will we face more than we think we can do ourselves and find that Jesus can do more than we think he can, but we also need to discover that Jesus can do more than what we know we need. Did you get that? Jesus can do more than what we know we even need. Jesus goes beyond what we think or what we can see. Jesus can meet our real needs that we might not even know about. Healing of this guy's son was needed, but there was something far greater needed for this man and for his family and really all of us. It was transformation. It was to face life differently, wasn't it? It's why Jesus, who's God in the flesh, came, right, to do for us what we could never do for ourselves, to save us from sin, to make us right with God. In fact, back to Colossians 1, we just found out in him the fullness of God dwells in bodily form, right? I want you to look at verse 20, because this is how Paul kind of closes the thought out about Jesus. He says, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. I didn't even know I was at war. Yet Jesus makes peace. Before we even knew. Remember Romans 5:8, where Paul says, and this is love, that God sent Christ to die while we were still sinners. Christ dies for us. Beyond what we even knew we needed, he met that need. That's worth trusting in. You see, Jesus didn't come to deliver the Jews from the Romans, as many of the people of the day thought. He didn't come to make the physically sick well, although he did that. He didn't come to make bad people good or good people better. Jesus came to make those that were spiritually dead alive. To make those who were, because of sin, unworthy, to make them worthy. To make those who were unrighteous, righteous. That's all of us. It's a need many of us don't even know we have, but we know something's missing. Jesus came to do that, and we trust in him. Even for what we don't know we need, but we know he can do more than what we even know we need. When this official first came to Jesus, he had no clue. That's what he needed. He had what he thought everything he needed, except his son was sick. So give me that, everything's back to normal. And he may at first have been satisfied with his son's healing and then going back to business as usual. But through Jesus and this building faith that Jesus builds in this guy, instead he goes further. He goes deeper. Not just trusting Jesus for what he knew he needed, but for what he didn't even know he needed for his life and his family. And now he clings to Jesus so much that it fundamentally alters the way he's going to live his life. Isn't that awesome? You see, true faith in Jesus trusts beyond what we know about Jesus to trusting in Jesus. Did you catch that? I fumbled it, so let me say it again. True faith trusts beyond what we know about Jesus to trusting in Jesus. Trusting him to work in us, to work around us, to work through us as he sees fit for our benefit and for his glory. Things he may do in us and through us a year from now that we have no clue he's going to do in and through us, and yet we're trusting him, that he knows what he's doing, so we're trusting him. That's true faith. So this is the second sign that Jesus performed. The second piece of crucial evidence that John kind of presents, designed to help us believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing we may have life in his name. Through this miracle, Jesus reveals that what true faith is all about. Begins realizing we can't do everything ourselves. It goes to then trusting that Jesus can do more than we think he can do. But then it finally rests in Jesus as the one who can do more than what we even think we know we need. You see, as we sum all this up, here's the point of the passage. And if you leave with just one thing today, leave with this. This kind of sums up our passage in a nutshell. It's this. True faith isn't just trusting Jesus, but trusting in Jesus. You see the difference there? It's not just trusting Jesus, it's trusting in him, because in him is the power, in him is the glory, in him is the forgiveness of sin, in him is life. See, he doesn't merely just give us life, in him is life. So we're trusting in him. True faith isn't about trusting Jesus, but trusting in Jesus. Let's pray.